I'm Dime Roberts. These are divisive times. Through the last few decades, some progress has been made in creating a more diverse and inclusive society. Some progress. Not enough, but some. Since the 2016 presidential election, racial divisions in America have become more visible, and racists have been emboldened and hate crimes are on the rise. There always has been a great need for us to listen to each other, not talk over each other to make divisive points, but to truly listen to marginalized groups and discussions about racism. But this isn't a story about black and white tensions. It's about relationships between two marginalized groups that have historically been pitted against each other. Asian Americans and African Americans haven't always worked together as well as we could. Most of the time, Asians have been singled out as a model minority to create a wedge against other racial groups. This is a story of that history and the surprising ways both groups are reaching out toward each other, and we'll be taking a look at younger generations working to eradicate the biases between these two groups with a new level of activism by getting together and talking to each other and then taking action. This is Crossing East Relations. Here's some history. In 2006, Meteorites created and broadcast the first Asian Pacific Islander, or API, history series on public radio. The series ran on 230 stations around the country. We had more than 50 scholars, radio producers, and artists working to produce 8 hours that covered API history from the land bridge across Asia to North America to racial profiling right after September 11, 2001. After the 10th anniversary of the series, Meteorites decided to create an archive of more than 100 hours of oral history interviews that we recorded. At the same time, I embarked on a new documentary, this one. Initially, it would be from the archive material, but then I re-listened to some prophetic interviews that speak to events in the last few years, to voices discussing the Los Angeles riots.
Right now, rescue 27.
Everybody's going crazy right now. Like the black gangs, the white gangs, the Korean gangs, anybody could drive up right now.
Probably two-thirds of South Central Los Angeles has been incarcerated or had some type of incarceration. The kids and the adults in these communities suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and hypervigilance. This is a war zone.
After the Rodney King verdict on April 29, 1992, there were 3 days and 4 nights of demonstrations, civil disobedience, rioting, looting, and arson. The riots ended with 55 people dead, nearly 2,300 injured, and another 10,000 arrested. When we were creating a radio story about the LA riots, we heard from African-American activist Akilah Shirelles in Los Angeles, who made this statement foreshadowing events to come.
I think that the LA riot was a precursor to something else that hasn't happened yet within the culture. I think that this country is actually headed for a civil war. And I think that we are being totally emotionally desensitized to violence against one another. I think that we're being pitted against each other on a large scale. The LA riot was a sign that unless we focus our energy and efforts on helping people to address the deep wounds within our own personal life, that we're going to see this whole country destroyed.
Akilah Shirelles' statement about deep wounds in 2005 rings true today, given the amount of police violence against African Americans caught on video in the last few years. The killing of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman and the deaths by police of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Alton Sterling, Akai Gurley, and Philando Castile intensified an ongoing movement for Black lives. Through the years, class disparity has increased. And I listened to another prophetic comment from the Crossing East series, this one from Angela Oh, a Korean-American teacher and attorney who gained national prominence as a voice for the Korean-American community. As Angela Oh spoke up for Koreans whose stores were being burned to the ground during the 1992 LA riots, she also made this prediction.
The fact of the gap between the wealthy and the poor growing, except now we're talking on a global scale. If anything's going to happen, it's going to happen in a place like Los Angeles, New York, Washington, D.C. And so if people are feeling that they want to work and they can't because there's just nothing, and if our housing crisis continues, if we continue on where people do not have access to health care, if we continue on where our solution to dealing with problems in our community is to jail young people for long periods of time without any program for rehabilitation, without any thinking that these are young people that are going to come back to our communities, we're just asking for another 1992.
During the LA riots or uprising, as it's come to be known, or in Korean, Saigu, which translates to April 29th, conflicts between African Americans and Korean Americans intensified. Throughout American history, marginalized groups have often been pitted against each other by the mainstream establishment. After listening again to Akilah Sherrill's and Angela Oh's foreshadowing statements in the Crossing East archive, I decided to do more listening and gather new recordings from activists, community scholars, and community members in Oregon and the Bay Area to answer these questions. Why have these two communities been pitted against each other? How can African American and Asian American communities work together? And how are younger activists building upon the groundwork of veteran activists to resist the attempts to divide us? Finally, how can we listen? The LA uprising in the 1990s was a catalyst for Asian American communities to look at ways to work with African American communities. But the relationship between these two marginalized groups goes back much further. One of the main scholars for the Crossing East series, Jaideep Singh, recommended I talk with Anirvan Chatterjee in the Bay Area.
For me, growing up in the U.S., I actually didn't really kind of get any kind of a sense from school or from my larger American community that there was any kind of connection at all between African Americans and South Asians. I mean, those connections were something that I actually learned more from my Indian community, my South Asian community, that my parents or other people around me would say, well, of course, you know, like the Black Civil Rights Movement, they learned so much from Gandhi, you know, like, and that was something that folks were really proud of.
Anirvan Chatterjee is one of the curators of the Berkeley South Asian Radical History Walking Tour. He is also one of the co-creators of the site BlackDesiSecretHistory.org that traces the history of South Asian and African-American solidarity. Chatterjee has traced this relationship that began in the 17th and 18th centuries.
These were South Asians who were coming to the U.S. as indentured servants and in some cases literally as slaves. I mean, there's records of runaway slaves who are marked as East Indian, like back in like 1768 and kind of in that period. So we can only imagine like what it might have been for these South Asians to be in African-American spaces, what kind of connections they made.
Chatterjee says following that initial migration came the Bengali Harlem, documented in a book and film by historian Vivek Bald.
And in it, he describes how from like the, say, the 1880s through, say, the 1930s or so, there was wave after wave after wave of folks from Bengal, largely the present-day nations of Bangladesh and to some extent Indian Bengal, who would be coming as traders to the United States, to the East Coast. And they would fan out up and down, going to places like Detroit, New York City, New Jersey. And they would often be peddlers. They'd be selling goods that they'd brought over with them from India. White communities would not have them. So they very quickly actually started connecting with and often marrying into Black communities, Black and Creole and Puerto Rican communities. There's a story of one Bengali man, for example, who married somebody who was literally the daughter of a slave. And just thinking about like what those conversations would have been like for somebody to be like, you know, these two people from like such entirely different worlds living together, having children and kind of going on through life. So for me, like that's kind of the moment when South Asians came to the United States in large numbers, in large-ish numbers relative to before. And we found comfort and we kind of found safety in Black America.
After the Bengali Harlem, Chatterjee says another wave of South Asian and African-American relations started in the 1930s to 1940s. Indians were not only dealing with independence from the British Empire, but with a caste system often based on color.
Suddenly, African-Americans start noticing India, and they see India as this nation of colored people who are resisting white empire. And in that process of resisting white empire, I mean, they were kind of really formulating new models on what it looks like to resist white imperialism. And there's all these statements and quotes and writing that we found where Black Americans really saw that as something that really kind of inspired them as well. Because if these colored people abroad could be working for their liberation, African America might be able to do that too. And my favorite thing that kind of came out of this was, it's 1942. It's the, you know, like it's the middle of World War II. And the NAACP could have been working on so many things, but they'd had some connections with a couple of Indian activists, and they came together and they put out this like large resolution, and they got thinkers and writers and poets to put out this entire package of supporting materials, really demanding freedom and autonomy for India, because they saw their liberation wrapped up in the liberation of India. Now, when I say India, this is the present-day nations of India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. But my favorite kind of piece from that time is a poem from by Langston Hughes called How About It? And it reads, in part, "Show me that you mean democracy, please. Because from Bombay to Georgia, I'm beat to my knees. You can't lock up Nehru, club Roland Hayes, then make fine speeches about freedom's way." And it gave me chills reading that for the first time, seeing him talk about the first Prime Minister of India, or Nehru, who was at the time a political prisoner captured by the British, and talking about a victim, a Black man who was a victim of police brutality, in the same poem, in the same sentence.
Chatterjee was personally inspired by activist Bayard Rustin's actions in India when the country gained freedom from the British Empire in 1947. Rustin is best known as the organizer of the 1963 March on Washington.
So in 1949, Bayard Rustin, who was risking arrest in D.C. to make sure that these, you know, Indian freedom fighters would actually be able to like oust the British from their country, he goes to visit India and he ends up meeting his fellow anti-colonial leader, who is now the Prime Minister of India. And there's this like beautiful photo of the two of them, just Nehru and Bayard Rustin hanging out and talking. And again, that's one of these photos that I wish every South Asian could see, just, you know, to see this like gay Black activist who was the right-hand man of Martin Luther King hanging out and talking to somebody who's actually really important for Indians, at least, our first prime minister. But this is where it gets interesting, because we were talking about MLK's visit to India in 1959, and that was something that was organized by Bayard Rustin as well. So in 1959, Martin Luther King goes to India, and he talks to Nehru, and he talks to other people there. And a lot of the folks who are going to India, Black American leaders who are going to India from the U.S., they'd be meeting these former anti-colonial freedom fighters who were the new government, and they would show up and they would sometimes realize that, I mean, this is great, you know, we're actually meeting the leaders of this nation of like hundreds of millions of people, but maybe Black America wasn't exactly in the same position as these new national leaders. And they started actually making connections with Dalit communities, and they started realizing that race and caste in many cases worked really similarly.
Chatterjee says this early solidarity between India's independence movement and the Black Liberation Movement directly connects with solidarity of Asian Americans for the current Black Lives Matter movement.
For over a century, South Asians have been standing with African America. African America has been standing with South Asia. And the cultures of resistance that have come out of that are, it's a very best part of a tradition. And we just need to be able to step up and say, that is something that we need to be able to teach and share. And I'm really hopeful that for younger generations of South Asian Americans, that's a tradition that they too can step into.
That was Anirvan Chatterjee, co-creator of the site BlackDesiSecretHistory.org, where you can find a history of South Asian and African American solidarity. You're listening to Relations, a documentary special for the Crossing East Archive Project. Throughout this hour, we're featuring music from Portland musician David Arnett Cherry. Hear more of his music at davidarnettcherry.com. I'm Dime Roberts. For more info on this documentary and the archive, visit crossingeast.org. The myth that Asians are somehow a community that has risen to success despite hard circumstances has been held up as something to emulate. Man, the model minority myth has caused so many problems for API communities, especially when it comes to getting along with other marginalized groups. Now, we heard about the early solidarity between African American leaders and South Asians, but the Immigration Act of 1965 changed the landscape of cross-cultural relationships. On the one hand, more Asian family members and skilled workers could freely immigrate to the U.S. and create more family unification. But in the late 1960s and till this day, an idea emerged to elevate Asians as the model minority.
In the 1960s, this idea of Asian Americans as a model minority is picked up by conservative media and by conservative politicians, and is used as an argument against civil rights for African Americans, basically. And particularly, not the idea of civil rights or legal inclusion, but particularly programs to help to resolve the legacy of racial inequality faced by African Americans in that period. So programs like busing and affirmative action, for instance.
Scott Nakagawa is an activist and writer. He founded a racial justice think tank called Change Lab, and he's written extensively about the model minority myth.
And so the case is made through talking about specifically at first the Japanese American community, that this is a community that was horribly persecuted, that started out in poverty, and within a couple of generations is now assimilating to the white middle class, has integrated itself into middle class suburbs and communities around America, and is enjoying an average family income that is comparable to that of middle class families in the United States, regardless of race.
This myth quickly became a way to first pit Japanese Americans and then Chinese Americans and each subsequent Asian group that immigrated against other minority groups, particularly African Americans. And the myth is still used by mainstream media, especially when talking about economic disparity in communities of color. Nakagawa says the Asian American model minority myth makes the case that minorities can pursue the American dream despite racial inequity.
The model minority basically suggests that Asians by culture, or in some instances even by biology, have a greater disposition toward success, value education more, work hard, are quiet, uncomplaining, cooperative, and are willing to make sacrifices in order to achieve a better life. It's hard to describe the model minority except in terms of what it's not. The model minority is not prone to criminality, not prone to protest, not disruptive, and willing to basically quietly work and do as they're told.
But when you look at the highest median family incomes of all groups in the U.S., many Asian Pacific Islanders are near poverty level. Nakagawa stresses it's APIs who arrive with college degrees and who are in the professional classes of workers that have higher incomes. He says the model minority concept is a story about labor.
Basically, what the model minority has done is class Asian Americans as highly exploitable managerial class laborers. Right? Wage earners, not owners. And, you know, with the kinds of characteristics that make you perfectly exploitable, you don't complain, you don't protest, you're quiet, you're cooperative, you work really hard, you allow your identity to be subsumed within the goals of the group, right? Really good team players with technical skills and proficiency and a really low error rate. And so the whole idea of race is one that originally is justified by ideas about culture and biology that were not actually things that people understood prior to, you know, the age of slavery in the United States and around that time. It's a very recent phenomena, and in the United States is a particularly American character to white supremacy.
Asian Americans have not historically shown support for African Americans. While there have been many times that African Americans and Asian Americans have worked together to fight discrimination and injustice, Nakagawa says those are the exceptions.
Well, throughout most of history, Asian Americans and African Americans have not stood up with each other. Right? Asian Americans in particular have tried to make the argument for citizenship historically by basically arguing that they aren't black. So, you know, when we talk about race in the United States, race and citizenship always go together. And so the fight for inclusion is a fight for citizenship rights. It is that even amongst undocumented immigrants today. Undocumented immigrants are a class of workers in the United States.
Yet Nakagawa thinks there are people challenging the model minority myth, especially a new generation of Asian American activists rising into leadership.
Well, there have been waves of activism throughout our history since the 60s against this idea of the Asian American model minority that's led by Asian Americans themselves. I think today the difference is that what people are reaching for is a kind of solidarity politic that would join together Asian Americans with other people of color in order to challenge white supremacy in the United States. And so there's a lot of promise there. What I think that in terms of solidarity we need to do is that we need to recognize that those instances when Asians and African Americans and other people of color have risen up together are exceptional moments in U.S. history. Most of the time, that's not what's happening. There's disunity, dissension, and tension, right? That's the normal state of things. And so we should be focusing not so much on the exceptional, which are, you know, circumstances that are often created by history, right? The historical accidents of those times, but on what's normal and try to understand what holds us in this state of disunity.
You can read Scott Nakagawa's essays on Race Files, a blog by Change Lab. I'm Dime Roberts. This is Relations, a documentary special for the Crossing East Archive Project. Check out more at crossingeast.org. Listening to Chinese Americans in New York City protesting the conviction of Officer Peter Liang. On November 20th, 2014, Akai Gurley was shot by a police officer, Peter Liang, in a stairwell in New York City. Gurley was 28 years old, African American, and unarmed. This was another of many police shootings of African American men. Peter Liang was a 27-year-old Chinese-American officer with less than 18 months of experience. He was convicted of manslaughter and official misconduct on February 11, 2016, but he was later given probation and community service. Some in the Chinese community believe this was a case of scapegoating because no white police officer to date has been prosecuted for shootings of unarmed African-American men. Most of the protests around the country came from first-generation Asian Americans. Asians who wanted to protest were simply not talking to the African-American community and only knew their own perspective. Meanwhile, in Portland, Helen Ying was hearing about plans of another protest.
This is what I learned from the local leader. You know, this is how he put it. He says, this is a young officer, whose parents don't even speak English. And when he was being tried, his parents couldn't even come to the trial, to the court, because they have to work.
Helen Ying is the National Vice President of Membership in the Chinese American Citizens Alliance. She spent many hours trying to explain the Peter Liang verdict to outraged Chinese immigrants, both in America and in China, who communicated through WeChat, the Chinese version of Facebook. One was a member of her organization who wanted to hold a protest rally in Portland.
So basically he's saying, you know, that this officer didn't even get really the time of day, because his parents, you know, they don't have the means, they might not even have been able to hire a lawyer that could represent him well.
This divided younger generations of Asian Americans who thought police officers should be held accountable no matter what.
And so what we have seen, like online, is a lot of Mandarin speaking, you know, folks who are newer immigrants from mainland China that are having this kind of response. And because a lot of the information they have received are from, you know, Chinese written language media.
When protests were being organized around the country in support of Peter Liang, Ying worked to connect the rally organizer with leaders in the African-American community to understand their perspective.
So when I got wind of this, I contacted our national network, you know, and like our national president says, hey, this is what's happening in Portland. What are you guys hearing about what's going on in other parts of the country? And so long story short, there was no incident. And one of the leaders, Teresa Rayford from Hands Up, Don't Shoot, that's the name of their group, she actually came and spoke at the rally alongside of other speakers that are Chinese Americans.
Younger Asian Americans were shocked. Portland activist Jenny Chu attended a workshop created by the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, APANO. It's a statewide grassroots social justice organization. The workshop helped her to unpack her discomfort about Asians rallying for a police officer.
It was actually so alarming for me as someone that grew up in Oregon to see a whole entire Chinese community in the United States gather together for this one event for Peter Liang. It was like so shocking to me because I had never put politics and Chinese Americans in the same category in my sort of vision of what being an activist looked like.
One Chinese group organizing the protest of Liang's prosecution contacted Joanne Hardesty, the president of the Portland chapter of the NAACP.
And so there was this elderly Chinese community outrage saying that, well, Officer Liang was being singled out for prosecution. And when white men kill black men, they don't get tried. And therefore, Officer Liang shouldn't be tried. And I remember getting a phone call from a friend of mine who is a business owner in the Asian Pacific Islander community and said, we have this community elder who's organizing this protest. So it was like 2 days before somebody thought, well, maybe we ought to check in with the African-American community and see how this is going to play out.
Hardesty says she was taken aback that an Asian group would be protesting the sentencing of a police officer who shot an unarmed African-American man. During the phone call, she turned her disquiet into a conversation in which she listened but also explained her perspective.
I had to really intentionally listen deeply to what this gentleman was trying to say to me because my initial instinct was to be outraged that he would want to defend the shooting and killing of an unarmed black man when it had been such an issue for the last couple of years. But I held my tongue. I listened deeply to what he had to say. I said to him, I'm concerned that this will be perceived as the Chinese community against the African-American community. And then he says, well, you should come and speak.
Instead, Joanne Hardesty invited the Chinese-American man to come to the next NAACP meeting.
And he did take me up on the offer. He did come to the NAACP meeting. We did have a conversation that was a bit heated, but respectful. And the good news is that he continues to come back, and he continues to be excited about the work that the NAACP is going. I made that story a lot longer than it needed to be to show you that I could have just said, this is racist, this is anti-black, and we're not having it. We don't want to be a part of it. We shouldn't have this conversation. But here's what happened when I had the same conversation. So after the conversation with the Chinese American Citizen Alliance, I emailed Joseph Lyons and said, have you heard about this rally?
Joseph Santos Lyons is APANO's executive director. After Hardesty contacted him, he led his organization to write a series of open letters in support of Black Lives Matter.
We took time to discuss internally within the organization about signing on to some public statements of support for Akai Gurley and really recognized the need for us to use this political moment to stand publicly and visibly out on the issue.
But the protests still went on in Portland.
I have no doubt that the Chinese American protests that happened downtown at Pioneer Square, despite some of the best intentions to build connections with the Black community, did create more division for us. And it portrayed, I think, the Asian American community largely as in opposition, maybe, to the interests of Black lives. I mean, frankly, I think those tensions between all of our communities a lot of the time. And I think communities of color in general are pitted against each other in part to distract from the systems of oppression, the way whiteness and white supremacy and the way systems are designed to benefit white people at the expense of people of color really necessitates communities of color not getting along.
For Joanne Hardesty, the work of negotiating racial divides continues, especially in a city like Portland, where, according to the 2015 census, it's more than 87% white.
There will always be misunderstandings and miscues. And the best we can hope for is that people will ask forgiveness and then be open to hear how that misperception harmed the person that heard it, right, on both sides. So whether it's the Asian Pacific Islander community or the Black community, when I'm struggling to hear someone, my fallback is to ask questions because I don't want to assume. I don't want to jump in and think that I know exactly what it was you were trying to say, right? So my fallback is always to ask questions for clarification. And then if it's a really, really hard conversation, it's okay to say, well, let's come back to that. Let me think on that, and let's come back and continue this conversation, right? So it doesn't have to, a uncomfortable conversation doesn't have to be a disagreeable conversation. It can be one where it happens in stages as people build comfort, as people build support. Then you can move to the hard place. But I say this always, change only comes in the uncomfortable spaces. And so you have to be willing to be uncomfortable to learn and to move forward.
That was Joanne Hardesty, president of the Portland chapter of the NAACP. This is Relations, a documentary special for the Crossing East Archive Project. Check out more at crossingeast.org. I'm Dime Roberts. We're hearing sounds from a Black Lives Matter action during Martin Luther King Jr. Day on January 18, 2016, when demonstrators blocked traffic on the San Francisco Bay Bridge.
It's hard to talk about the early days of the Black Lives Matter movement because when I say BLM, I'm talking about the Black Liberation Movement. And that's been around for a very long time.
Malkia Amala Searle is the co-founder and executive director for the Center for Media Justice, which works towards digital literacy. She also co-founded the Media Action Grassroots Network. Searle says she's been part of the Black Lives Matter Network since before it was Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter, the work that happened in the uprising in Ferguson, on the uprisings that have happened in Baltimore, Chicago, and all over this country, the birth of the Black Lives Matter Network, all of these things are part of a long lineage, you know, of Black resistance and fighting for liberation. So what I'll say is this. In 2012, you know, when Trayvon Martin was killed and George Zimmerman was acquitted for his murder, Black Lives Matter formed a national network. But before that, Michael Brown had been killed. And the people of Ferguson rose up in response to that killing. The fact is that you can look back to Watts, and you can look back to every Black urban rebellion across the history of this nation, and they've all been in response to the murder of a young Black person.
Searle became an activist when she was a child. Her father was a member of the Black Liberation Army, but it was her mom who was her major influence. A prominent leader in the Black Panther Party, Searle's mom was the editor of their newspaper and coordinated the Black Panther breakfast program in Brooklyn and Harlem. Searle says there were always tensions between the Black and Asian communities then, but she remembers fondly a civil rights activist visiting her mom. Searle called her Auntie Yuri Kochiyama.
And I would spend, you know, many evenings in her Harlem apartment, which was just full to the brim of paper. I never seen nobody house with that much paper before. But she just had newspapers and all kind of papers in her house. And, you know, we would sit there under the table listening to their meetings and along with the other kids.
In an oral history interview by Densho Digital Archive, Yuri Kochiyama remembered her time in Harlem and the impact Black liberation had on her activism.
Well, I think the Black liberation movement had an influence on every movement because they were really more advanced. And I think all the other movements sort of followed suit, knowing what racism has done to this country and this feeling of white superiority that has spread all over the world. But I think the Asian movements were good because they wanted to have some connection with Puerto Ricans and Blacks.
Yuri was brilliant. She was passionate. She would cuss you out and she would hug you up. She was extremely passionate. She loved her people, and her people were so many different kinds of people. Her people was the left, and she had a particular commitment to Black lives, I think in part because she understood very deeply, in a way very few others do, that a model minority framework or stereotype is built on the back of a criminal minority stereotype. The two stereotypes can only exist in relationship to one another. And so, and she understood that, I think, very early, before the interrogation of the model minority concept became something that was happening on a regular basis. I felt like she was doing that. And so I didn't find her to be like hugely like an academic, but she was deeply brilliant, full-bodied brilliant, and she understood these ideas, I think, before many other people did.
The kind of understanding Kochiyama displayed is something that activists of her generation worked toward. And just as the Black Liberation Movement had no centralized network, Searle says the Black Lives Matter Network doesn't rely on one leader. She says it has a decentralized leadership style where everyone works to listen to each other. It's a network that was largely founded by women, many of them queer. And she says Black Lives Matter is an international movement.
We got a chapter. We got chapters in Canada. We got chapters in the UK. There are chapters throughout Africa. There are chapters in Brazil. I mean, there are chapters all over the world. And I think that it's important to note that, right? Internationalism is one thing as an ideology, but actually having an international movement where Black Lives Matter is the chant, you know, on the streets in London, and the Black Lives Matter Network, you know, has chapters across this country. It's unique in part because it carries the legacy of the Black Panther Party forward. The Black Lives Matter Network speaks for and is of those who are pushed to the margins of even Black movements, right? So queer folks, trans folks, women, children, you know, those who are poor, those who are in prison. You know, this is not about a narrow cultural nationalism.
Searle says in the Bay Area, Asians for Black Lives has become an important ally to the Black Lives Matter members. These Asian American activists, along with other allies, have demonstrated what solidarity looks like when Black Lives Matter activists participated in direct actions like shutting down the public transit system in the Bay Area.
Asians for Black Lives was an incredible solidarity team for these individuals that have put their freedom on the line. Because obviously, once you've taken that kind of civil disobedience, it'd be difficult to do more after that, especially because now you're in court, right? And you're on trial for the crime, or for what the court is calling a crime. And it was because we had the solidarity of Asians for Black Lives, also Bay Rising, which was at the time largely white folks, you know, who were standing in to offer solidarity, and others who were able to really stand up and be a front line for those folks that have put themselves on the line.
Malkia Searle thinks the solidarity of activists in the Bay Area are part of a global effort to fight back against the ravages of global capitalism, which started as colonialism and the slave trade. Searle says we are all connected.
My life depends upon the lives of, you know, children in Vietnam and in Thailand. Like, the fact of the matter is, right now, for example, every cell phone you use, you know, somebody somewhere in some other country put that thing together, you know, and when it is gone, and most likely that person was in Asia, and when that cell phone gets destroyed, that e-waste is going to somewhere in Africa. The point is that everything we touch, right? We're in a global economy, but we're just in a global society. Everything we touch touches somebody else. And so you can't win your liberation by yourself. It's not possible. You need all of those people who are affected by those systems to stand up together. And the only way you get that is if you stand down for a minute and listen. Listen to what people's experiences have been. Listen to them in their own words, in their own languages. Recognize that colonialism, especially in America, is very different than how it is every place else in the world.
Malkia Searle, part of the Bay Area Black Lives Matter Network. I'm Dimae Roberts, Crossing East Relations, a documentary for Meteorite's Crossing East Archive Project. We looked at historic tensions and cooperation in the Asian and Black communities. How are younger activists in both communities standing up for each other?
Asians for Black Lives was formed right after the non-indictment of Eric Garner's murderer.
Ellen Choi works as a member of the Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project.
And at that time, the Black Lives Matter movement had really bloomed across the country, and we saw that we were in a political moment. And so me and some of my Asian comrades, friends, got together because we wanted to see, we really wanted to start with dialogue. Where are we positioned as Asian community organizers and activists here in the Bay Area?
Choi is also a member of Asians for Black Lives in the Bay Area. That group is also decentralized. It was formed right after local Asian Americans had discussions about the non-indictment of police officers involved in the death of Eric Garner. She says the group needed to heed a call from Black Lives Matter activists for allies to step up and support their movement.
OPD! How you spell murder?
OPD!
How you spell murder?
OPD!
The first direct action Asians for Black Lives took was at the Oakland Police Department.
And our job there was to shut down the Oakland Police Department in protest and also to hold space for the Black organizers who came and held their own space, chanted, were at the forefront of the media images and leading the action. Our role was to put our bodies on the line in some of the more riskier areas physically and emotionally. So we were the ones who actually shut down, locked ourselves to the doors at the Oakland Police Department while the Black organizations were able to hold their own space, but they were not in a position to be arrested or put at risk like we were. There have been other other types of actions where black folks are locking down alongside us, or they've decided that they want it to be an all-black action, and so they're the only ones taking the risk, and we're doing other kind of behind-the-scenes support. I think the key part is, one, is just taking black leadership and understanding what it means to center the black leadership and working alongside them.
Ellen Choi says her experience growing up in Los Angeles and living through what happened after the Rodney King beating and police acquittal shaped her beliefs. Beliefs that it isn't just the responsibility or the obligation of African Americans to defend their communities and their lives. Choi says Asian Americans can benefit from the liberation of black people, despite the myth of Asians as the model minority.
We both have a stake in this fight, where we understand that if black folks, you know, every inch of black liberation that we were able to win will benefit and impact our communities and our own liberation. But at the same time, we are also positioned in the United States to be in a position of power and have some leverage in our privilege as being uplifted as the model minority historically. And that myth, you know, that really destructive myth that the U.S. empire has really upheld has put us in a position of power in this country in relationship to black folks. And because of that, we also have more leverage, more access to those systems of power, and also more of a responsibility to step up. So I think we're trying to hold the balance of both of those sides of our identities in relationship to this movement. And so because of that, we also feel it's really important to put our bodies on the line alongside of black folks.
Ellen Choi says Asians for Black Lives also works to counter anti-blackness by Asian folks. Anti-blackness is a term used by younger generations of activists to address prejudice against African Americans, especially by other marginalized groups. At one event, Asians for Black Lives held an action at the Chinese New Year celebration and passed out red envelopes with names of Asian and Black activists who have worked together.
So there was one of them highlighted the relationship between Yuri Kochiyama and Malcolm X, Grace Lee Boggs and Jimmie Lee Boggs was another one, Thich Nhat Hanh and Martin Luther King, I think, was the other. So we went out with this information to pass out the red envelopes, but also every time a red envelope was passed out, we started a conversation. So it was kind of an organizing tactic.
Choi says the tactic was to respectfully call attention to Black lives.
We had Black Lives Matter written in Chinese. And then we also ended up projecting that on some of the floats coming by. It was pretty fun. But the idea was to kind of disrupt in a more narrative way and to include a message that while our, you know, we didn't want to disrupt in a way that was disrespectful to the actual event. And so for us, it was like, you know, it's Lunar New Year is a time for our communities to celebrate, but let's also remember there are black families across the country who are mourning the death of their daughter or their son. And so we, you know, that's kind of what held us up to have this action together.
During the inauguration of the 45th president, Choi says Asians for Black Lives decided to be agents for Black Lives. So they tried a new form of action the week of Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
What we decided as Agents for Black Lives is that we would actually try a new form of action this year, that it wasn't going to be about, again, like shutting down any building or going to a place of power. But what we were going to do is actually help and support an action that was already brewing, led by a group called Feed the People, that was actually a very visionary action. So what we ended up doing was reclaiming public land in West Oakland at a park that was historically neglected by the city. The city hadn't been actually servicing the park except for trash collection. And we reclaimed that park and started to build what we called the Village. And the residents ended up lovingly renaming it the Promised Land. But the idea was that we would actually literally build homes for houseless folks, reclaim space, and build a village of community, a village of support, a village where houseless folks can come, get services, get food, and be heard.
To listen, to be heard, and to take action for positive change. Ellen Choi says that action drew attention to the housing crisis during the Martin Luther King Jr. Day celebrations. Ellen Choi continues to work as an activist with Asians for Black Lives in Oakland, California. I'm Demi Roberts. We're listening to David Arnett Cherry, a musician and composer in Portland, Oregon. Hear his music at davidarnettcherry.com. I grew up in Oregon, a state with a strong history of exclusionary laws against people of color. I was always used to being one of the few, if not only, Asian Americans in the room wherever I went. There are some rural communities that are majority Latino. And at times, like during World War II, there was a vibrant African-American community working in Vanport, outside of Portland, for the Kaiser shipyards, until the 1948 flood decimated the town. Living in Oregon now presents people of color an even greater challenge than more diverse states. According to the U.S. Census, Oregon has gone from 83% white in 2010 to 87% in 2015. That's largely due to increased white migration and perhaps to people of color moving away. In a recent interview by the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, Scott Nakagawa said, "People often say they move to Oregon because it's safe." He said safe appeared to be a code word for white. And Nakagawa said rural Oregon is under siege by paramilitary white nationalist groups. People in Oregon, especially people of color, are gathering more and more in workshops and discussion groups to unpack their thoughts and perspectives on social issues of the day, especially about race and identity. I attended one conversation about the model minority myth hosted by Apano's Kara Carmosino. Dorian Smith came to a workshop at the Asian and Pacific Cultural Center at Oregon State University. Smith is an African-American grad student who moved to Corvallis, Oregon.
I've had discrimination from a lot of people, but I think that's just part of being an American.
Originally from Los Angeles, Smith says he was surprised by the level of anti-blackness he's encountered from people who just never interacted with African-Americans before.
You know, I'm a 31-year-old, so I don't feel too old, but just in our culture and in our music, I just get called the N-word a lot by people that aren't black, and it's such an interesting topic. So to hear that from some friends of mine that are Asian American and that might be listening to something and think it's cool to say that around me and doesn't exactly know how that affects me is something that I've had to deal with and had to have some serious conversations with and got into some heated conversations, almost some physical things. So being a person of color here, especially a black person here, especially a large black person here, but it's something that you deal with, and that's the story of being a black man. You have to navigate that wherever you go.
So it's a lot of fear associated with African Americans.
At another workshop at Apano's Rolling Tides convention, Jay Singh talked about anti-blackness with his family members.
There was one incident where my uncle was stabbed. He worked at a store. And so that sort of left an impact and impression on my family. And so it was that stereotype of African Americans of being, you know, violent and just scary in general, that sort of perpetuated in my family, and we had to do a lot more unlearning compared to other families.
Singh says talking consistently about Black and API solidarity is crucial.
I think, I mean, individual conversations are very critical when we're at the dinner table, when we're at, you know, prayer services or whatever. I think that sort of, it starts there with our own families, folks that we see every day or regularly that we love. I feel like that's where we have the most impact. And it can be difficult because those relationships can be fragile. And so it's hard for me. I have to admit, it's really hard to have those conversations with close folks that I've known for a long time. And I know that, and because it can break real easily if we get there. So, but I think we have to be brave and commit to those conversations to sort of demolish this anti-blackness.
Younger generations of APIs fully embrace the idea of African-American and API unity. Lexa Machinsky, a biracial Filipina student at Wilson High School, also attended Apano's convention.
I think with what I'm seeing with students and younger generations, like how we are trying to fix it, I think raising awareness on them, because we as a community have gone through injustices. Many of them never intersect with the Black community because sometimes there are just things that we have never had to overcome. But at the same time, we do have the empathy. And so I think that we just have to find the capacity to be aware of it. And we have to find ways to share it with each other. I do think that just being there as a support is something that we can definitely do, and I don't see enough of it.
Machinsky says young APIs are trying to find solutions collectively.
I have an immense amount of hope that in the future, everything will get better. It's probably going to be like much harder to overcome some things, but I do believe that all the communities, all the minorities have the capability to get together and just fight it one at a time, baby steps. But yes, I do believe immensely, and I think that there's great hope for it.
While it's important for individuals to change their own beliefs, it takes all communities to create systemic changes regarding anti-Blackness in America. Throughout our history, Asians and Blacks have often been pitted against each other to benefit white supremacy. There have been times when Black and Asian communities have worked together to achieve civil rights. As Lexa Machinsky said, it's baby steps. Perhaps that's what we're all still undergoing, those baby steps, when it comes to African American and Asian American solidarity. Crossing East Relations was produced by Dime Roberts, executive producer of Media Rights, and was made possible by the Oregon Cultural Trust, the Oregon Arts Commission, and the Regional Arts and Culture Council. Associate producers were Robin Takayama and Alan Montecilio, with collaborative support from Kara Carmazzino of the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon and their Model Minority Workshops. We had script consultation from Catherine Stifter. Our engineer was Clark Salisbury. Audio recordings of marches provided by M. Lin, community organizer at API Equality, Northern California. You've been listening to music by Portland musician and composer David Arnett Cherry. Hear more of his music at davidarnettcherry.com. For more info on this program, the Crossing East series, and the Crossing East Archive, visit crossingeast.org or mediarights.org. This is a Media Rights production. I'm Dime Roberts.